I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Every mother is at risk for developing postpartum depression. It can happen months after giving birth or before the baby even arrives. But treatment isn't always affordable or accessible for the women who need it. Today, a look at the different treatment options for postpartum depression and why women in rural areas face a greater risk of being affected. Then, the 1955 Mississippi murder of a young black boy from Chicago was one of the sparks that lit the fire of the civil rights movement. Today, how commemorating that death has become an economic windfall for some in the Delta area. Remembering Emmett Till on Up to Date after this hour's news. Postpartum depression is often confused with baby blues, but it's actually a little different. Turns out that about 1 in 7 women experience postpartum depression, and a lot of them are in low-income areas. We want to know why, what the treatment options are, and why some options aren't as accessible to the women who really need it. With us to talk about this, Dr. Rebecca Lobel is an OBGYN at St. Luke's East. Dr. Lobel, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jessica Cisneros is a nurse midwife at St. Luke's East and a leader of a PPD support group. Jessica, welcome to you too.
Thanks for having us.
Dr. Lobel, you know, 1 in 7 women strikes me as a whole lot. Why is postpartum depression so common?
I think it's so common because there are so many risk factors that can sort of lead to this condition.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those risk factors include living in a lower income area, lack of social support,
sure,
teen pregnancies, single moms, or moms with, again, limited family support. History of depression and anxiety is the most common one. And a lot of times I think that lack of resources that you mentioned leads to this being poorly controlled prior to pregnancy and then resulting in more significant symptoms during and afterwards.
Yeah. You know, Jessica, just what Dr. Lobel said, this notion that if a woman has a history of depression, what impact might that have when it comes to the likelihood of getting postpartum depression for that woman?
Typically, when they already have a history of depression, we always try to screen for that and look out for it more. But adding another stressful life event when they already have previously had stressful life events, maybe financial, lack of support, single parents, then that added stress, hormonal changes can really increase their risk of having that depression.
What is postpartum depression? How would you define it?
So postpartum depression, it really can occur anytime during pregnancy or postpartum. Typically anything
so
that,
during pregnancy too, even before the baby's born.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Even we see lots of women who are having those stressful life changes that start showing signs in their third trimester that we are on high alert, that are higher risk to have it after delivery as well.
Yeah.
Postpartum depression, typically we see it. It's not typically in the first 2 weeks. Those are baby blues. Typically a lot of moms go through lack of sleep and adding a new baby, but it's when you start to lose interest in your activities, that you're not able to care for your baby, care for yourself, and it can last anywhere in the first month is the most common that it happens, but it can all the way occur anytime in the first year after having a baby.
You know, Dr. Lobel, you read stories once in a while about how severe postpartum depression can be. How severe can it get?
I have had 2 instances in my career where I have seen postpartum psychosis, and it's probably one of the most frightening things I have ever seen.
What is that exactly?
So you basically get to a point where your postpartum depression has become so severe that you develop psychotic features. And so, you know, that primarily be, you know, thoughts of hurting yourself or hurting others, hearing voices, seeing things, people telling you to do certain things.
Mm.
And they really almost disassociate from reality.
Jessica, there's a sense here that there's a group of symptoms involved with postpartum depression. What do you mean by that? What does that include?
So I hate to just say postpartum depression because there's so many different types of postpartum mood disorders. We typically associate it with postpartum depression, but one of the most common we see is actually postpartum anxiety, which can stem to postpartum depression. And then we see a lot of moms that also have postpartum OCD, where they are concerned about how much their baby's taking in, how much their baby's taking out, how much sleep they're getting, and they have to track it all down.
They can't leave the baby alone, basically.
Yep. Yeah. And then they're afraid to sleep because they're afraid what if they miss a wet diaper or what if something happens to their baby. There can be also postpartum PTSD. Maybe their delivery was different. They may have had a NICU admission. Maybe they delivered early, which then that can lead to postpartum psychosis. It's one of the few other disorders as well.
You know, doctor, you read about this idea that every woman is at risk. Is that true?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
No question about that.
I have individuals that have every, you know, you would think, and they honestly get so upset because they feel so bad for feeling bad because they think they have everything that anyone should want.
They have a new baby.
They have a new baby. They have a great husband. They have great family support. They have a good job. They have no financial stressors. So, and then they have this horrible feeling about themselves, and then it's compounded because they don't think they should feel this way. And I really want to hit on what Jessica said because postpartum anxiety is so much more common than postpartum depression. And that's really something women need to take home because they think, oh, I'm not sad, so I don't have postpartum depression. So that anxiety component is so huge. And what is so important about the screening tools that we have specifically designed for postpartum, because it takes out some of those common depression symptoms that we see outside of pregnancy and highlights those anxiety symptoms.
And anxiety would manifest itself how?
So commonly you'll see lack of sleep. So not being able to sleep when the baby is sleeping is a big one.
Because you're checking on the baby all the time.
Yes, correct. Yeah. Or they're just mind won't shut off. Mm-hmm. Constantly worrying, having sort of these intrusive thoughts that something bad is really going to happen even though everything is okay. So that's really the cusp of the anxiety component.
You know, Jessica, I'm sitting here thinking, you know, one of the big issues for any new mom is this idea of lack of sleep. And I know how wiggy I get when I don't get regular sleep. And how big of a factor is that here?
I think it's a huge factor in it as well. Whether it's you can't sleep because you have maybe a fussy baby who isn't sleeping well, or you just can't turn your mind off so you can't sleep, your mind starts to wander and you start getting these thoughts in your head. Many of these moms, partners, if they do have support, have gone back to work and they're all alone by themselves, or they're afraid to ask for help because they feel they should be able to do it themselves. But I feel lack of sleep is one of the major key factors in that as well.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking today about postpartum depression, postpartum anxiety. We have a couple of terrific experts here in the house with us. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our number. Again, 816-235-2888, or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. What about women, Jessica, who live in rural areas? I mean, they're said to be at higher risk. Why?
Lack of support. There's
no one nearby.
No one nearby. Many times they may be not have any family members nearby. They're very isolated, and the resources that are provided. They don't have a support group. They don't have their provider. Maybe not nearby. There's no psychiatrist. There's no provider for them to talk to about it. They're pretty much all alone.
So what do they do? What can they do?
Well, we've developed in our community, we've developed a support group that is free because a lot of them maybe they can't afford to come pay somebody to come. So we try to develop support groups around the town that they could come to.
That might mean a long drive, though.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of them don't have access to a car. So a lot of them, hopefully they can talk with their provider, talk with family. Some places, there's even crisis hotlines that we have that they can call in specifically to talk to somebody if they need to.
Yeah. You know, I read about this one study Dr. Lobel, that said that poor women were 11 times more likely to develop postpartum depression symptoms than women of higher socioeconomic status. Why would that be? What's the connection there?
I think we've already really hit on that connection. It's that lack of support and resources. And oftentimes you have more stressors financially, as well as, again, being in certain higher stress situations.
Mm-hmm.
And again, you add in a major life event and someone who already lacks some of those tools, and then you change hormones, et cetera, and lack of sleep, and you're easily in a situation that can spiral out of control.
You know, this notion, Jessica, that the world's changing, we have the internet, you can connect with people on FaceTime and everything else, does that come into play with some of your support group work?
I know we've considered looking into a new pilot program where if someone would come into our office or some of the other offices in the area, that they can FaceTime somebody to talk over the phone to see if they're in need of immediate treatment or if it's something we can work on in the office as an outpatient, or if, to diagnose to see if maybe they need inpatient treatment as well.
I'm wondering, is this whole idea of postpartum anxiety, the blues, depression, does it get as much attention as it should?
I don't think it does.
I don't have a sense that it does either.
No, I really don't think it does. I think there's been several celebrities recently who have came out and have started talking about it. I have seen several Facebook groups they have started to create, and I think it's really important that people talk about it and not shy away from it. It's nothing to be ashamed of. Do not be embarrassed. It's a medical condition. It's a diagnosis of something that we can treat if people speak up about it.
You know, Rebecca, and maybe part of this is due to the fact this is sort of counterintuitive, isn't it? You've just given birth. You've had this, what supposedly be this great, glorious moment in your life, and then suddenly you're down. It doesn't make sense. And I'm wondering if people go into this just oblivious to the fact that this could happen to them.
I think a lot of times, yes, they do. And because they anticipate being happy, that guilt really weighs them down. We try to, as best we can, address it early on and mention it and talk about it. Our patients get screened in the beginning of pregnancy. They get screened before they leave the hospital to kind of flag them we usually see them 6 weeks postpartum, so do they need to be seen sooner? And then we screen them again when they come in 6 weeks postpartum. So we are bringing it up both verbally and then with this written screening questionnaire, which really allows them to maybe feel a little safer about writing down how they feel.
Yeah.
And it's quick. It takes less than 5 minutes. Even if you don't want to do it, you do it.
So you actually do this before moms leave the hospital?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and then again later on.
And honestly, I have picked up a lot of women that I would never have guessed were feeling that way. And then you ask them,
because of what they said in the written response.
Because of what they said in the written response. And it's a very validated tool that if you score above a certain number, you are at higher risk for postpartum depression. And so then it allows me to really open, you know, start the flow of communication with a mom when if you just say, are you feeling depressed? They'll say no. And then I say, well, you took that screening questionnaire and you scored, you know, this number, and that concerns me a little bit. Tell me more about these feelings. And then you will get this, you know, whole sort of verbal
avalanche
of how they're really feeling. And it's like, oh my gosh, they were holding that all inside. And so you can get them into treatment so much, you know, more quickly and start putting them, you know, resources into place.
I was going to say, what do you do if a woman scores high? What's the next step at St. Luke's East?
I address it. I first talk about, here's the diagnosis, and I really highlight what Jessica said, that this is a medical condition. This is no different than me offering you insulin for your diabetes.
Okay.
And I think that's something key to mention to them, that it is a medical condition. It's just not, you know, something that we made up to, you know, sound better than the baby blues. And so then I talk about different treatment options. I think the first and foremost thing to know is that the best results have really shown, like long-term results have come with a combination of counseling and therapy and antidepressant medication. Mm-hmm. But not everybody needs both. And so we talk about sort of different approaches, different steps. But I really say if we're not going to do therapy or do actual medical therapy to start, we need to keep a closer eye on you and you need to check in with me, you know, sooner to see how you're doing.
Well, Jessica, speaking of medication, there is this new drug that supposedly can help. The FDA approved it in March. It's the first drug approved specifically for postpartum depression. But the problem, the rub here, it comes with a hefty price tag, $34,000, and it requires a stay in a healthcare facility. What can you tell us about this new drug and what you know about it?
From what I know about it, I believe it was like 60 hours of continuous therapy, and it's very expensive. Most of the patients who we are talking about that are high risk don't have the resources to pay for it, and taking them away from their baby can increase their risk of anxiety, their depression. Many of the moms I see, that is the number one thing they are concerned about, is being away from their baby, especially if they're breastfeeding. It really can be counterintuitive to have them go stay 2 to 3 days in a hospital away from their baby, not able to breastfeed, and then the financial stress on top of it.
I was going to say, I've read that insurance companies are not paying for this new therapy. Am I right about that?
I haven't had any experience necessarily with trying to prescribe it or what insurances cover or not. So I'm not sure about that.
Dr. Lobel, have you dealt with this new drug yet?
I have not prescribed it. And I will tell you, it's pretty far down on my list. Where I would consider it as someone who has failed other therapies, and we're looking at more an inpatient hospitalization for severe postpartum depression or psychoses.
I see.
And at that point, it'd probably take a team, you know, both an OBGYN, a psychiatrist, et cetera, to talk about prescribing it and getting insurance on board.
Yeah. Jessica, if a mom lives out in a rural part of Kansas or Missouri, how can she figure out if, in fact, she's got postpartum depression? Is there some way to gauge that?
The best thing I would have her do is hopefully she could talk to her provider, would be the first step of person to contact.
Someone else beside herself who can maybe register an opinion about how she's doing.
Yeah. Her provider could administer the EPDS, which is an Eidenberg scale. They're online. If she's concerned, if she has access to the internet, she could look that up herself, score, and see where she's at on that if she doesn't have access to the provider. Depending on what her score is, then I would definitely recommend her talking to her provider.
Okay.
Our patients actually often call in saying, you know, reporting some symptoms, and our triage nurses do it over the phone all the time, flag the provider, we bring them in.
Mm-hmm. Have them come in to St. Luke's, yeah. What does St. Luke's offer in the way of support groups, Jessica, because that's right down your alley here.
So we've created the Postpartum Depression Support Group. We started this doing training through the Postpartum Resource Center, which they have other groups in the area as well. But recently in the last year, our group in St. Luke's East is the only group in the whole health system currently. What we do is it's a 3-week program where it's not just open to St. Luke's patients. Anybody in the area can come. Because we want to make it available. We want to make sure those women who don't have access to health care or don't have child care can come, because we do offer child care with advance notice as well, because that's a number one concern too, is I need somewhere to take my child. So our support group is we've condensed it to a 3-week program where we initially start talking about those different type of postpartum mood disorders that we had talked about. We have a goal every week. We also talk about how their spouses are affected or partners. We also talk about myths and realities of being a mom, which I know you kind of touched on that as well. Many women go into having a baby with all of these myths that it's going to be perfect and they're going to sleep. And then we finish it up with a wellness guide.
Mm-hmm. And this is one of those situations where the light bulb goes off for a lot of moms when they realize they're not in this alone.
Right. And that's the main thing I think I like about our support group, is when we get our patients there together and they can talk and they realize that there's another mom going through what they are going through, that they open up a little bit more and they can share their experiences and how they dealt with it. So they're more opt than more me just facilitating the group and giving them tools to help them, but they're also learning and building relationships with other moms.
How can moms connect with the support group?
We have a Facebook page, the St. Luke's Facebook page or the St. Luke's website. There's information on where our support group is and the times. We are usually meet the first Wednesday of the month due to the holiday. We're actually meeting tonight at 5:30 at our office in Lee Summit. And then the third Saturday of the month as well. The times and how to register for it are all on the St. Luke's website.
Sounds good. Let's go to some phone calls at 816-235-2888. We're talking about postpartum depression. Garrett from Kansas City, Kansas. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, go ahead, Garrett.
So I had a quick question or just a comment. I've heard a lot of the discussion so far, and I haven't heard anything about the nutritional component or the influence of nutrition on these states of being in the moms, especially after pregnancy. I mean, nutritional factors are huge in pregnancy, as we know, and that's why everybody takes the prenatal vitamin. But if you actually check, I've seen rich people, poor people, all the above, not being able to keep up with the nutrients they need. And after pregnancy, the copper and zinc levels particularly can get disrupted, and both of those have been linked to depression and psychosis.
Hmm.
I was just wondering what your thoughts were about that. I mean, if you can just keep those normalized and supported in these individuals, a lot of times that's all it takes to pull them out of some of these adverse states they find themselves.
Talk to us about zinc levels, Dr. Lobel, and how important nutrition is here.
Nutrition is always important in all aspects of health. As far as I know, there hasn't been any studies to support low zinc levels association with postpartum depression. Mm-hmm. You do need to keep up, though, with your diet and calorie intake in order to support breastfeeding, and that is very important. As we talked about earlier, breastfeeding concerns are a huge risk factor for postpartum depression and anxiety. So mm-hmm. That nutritional aspect is obviously very important.
Yeah. Well, I imagine giving birth and the disruption to one's system and levels of all kinds of things in your body must just go kittywampus pretty quickly.
Yeah. Yes, there are many changes that drastically occur after childbirth. Just hormone changes that can just affect your entire body, your sleep, your eating habits, a whole host of things.
Yeah. Kim from Overland Park. Kim, you're on Up to Date.
Yeah, I just wanted to also give the listeners another opportunity for resources. The Parents as Teachers program, we have a lot of resources and connections to help new moms deal with postpartum depression and those expectations that we talked about a little bit ago. What is normal? What is not normal? And it's somebody that can come in the home, provide child development teaching, and help the mothers know that what you're feeling is normal. Or we also have training on, like you said, we do the Edinburgh and be like, I think this is something that we need to take to the next level and get families in touch. But it's another great resource for parents who are new to parenthood just to feel more secure and to learn about what the babies are doing and why
right. You
may be reacting the way you're reacting.
Kim, that's Parents as Teachers, right?
Uh-huh, correct.
Yeah. Thanks for calling in. I appreciate that.
Uh-huh.
You know, a couple final points I wanted to touch on. Is there a connection, Jessica, between a mom having postpartum depression and a child getting the depression later in life?
I'm not all that sure. I haven't looked up the statistics on that, but a lot of depression in general can be genetic. There is a genetic component. Many of the moms who do have postpartum depression do have an underlying depression component, which that can be genetic and passed down to their child as well.
Now, for a final twist here, 10% of new fathers experience symptoms of depression during the postpartum period, and half of men who have partners with postpartum depression will go on to develop depression themselves. What do we know about the impact on men?
I mean, it's huge. I mean, we talked about it. Yes, there's a hormonal component for women giving birth, but men are also experiencing this new life change and stressor. So we do often leave out the partners. It's something, especially when there's a traumatic birth experience where you have a preterm birth or a child in the NICU, I will talk to both mom and dad and ask dad similar questions.
Oh, really? And what help can dads get?
Similar. I think that Parents as Teachers is a great resource, but I encourage them to seek out their primary care provider. Obviously, if they're not a patient of mine, I can't prescribe them medication.
Ashley from Gardner, good morning.
Hi. I have known some people who struggle with postpartum depression and also when they stopped breastfeeding, so the post-nursing depression, and I was wondering if those two were somehow related.
After you stop breastfeeding, Jessica?
I think it can be. There's many of reasons that you can stop breastfeeding, whether it's the baby is weaned off nursing or that you have stopped nursing for a reason. Many times that can cause some hormonal fluctuations in your body as your hormone levels all change. Like I say, the postpartum depression can really stop or develop any time in the first year.
Okay, we're going to leave our good conversation right there. That was the voice of Jessica Cisneros. She's a nurse midwife at St. Luke's East and a leader of a postpartum depression support group. Jessica, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Dr. Rebecca Lobel, an OBGYN at St. Luke's East. Doctor, thank you very much as well.
My pleasure.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll revisit the case of Emmett Till. His murder in Money, Mississippi back in 1955 altered the civil rights movement. And we'll talk about how that death is being remembered today. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, we discussed Kris Kobach's newly announced U.S. Senate campaign and learned about his relationship with the Trump administration. Find that and other episodes at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, now that the Plaza Cinemark movie theater has closed, is there a place for Kansas City youths to just hang out? It's a familiar question, and we'll find out how things look these days from the perspective of one local teen. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, to this day, we don't know what really happened in Money, Mississippi that day in 1955 when 14-year-old Emmett Till supposedly whistled at a white woman. We do know that Till paid for that alleged transgression with his life. He was tortured and murdered, and his body was dumped in the Tallahatchie River. The death is hailed these days as the launch of the modern-day civil rights movement. University of Kansas professor Dave Tell writes about how the murder is recalled today in the Mississippi Delta, where Till lived and died. Turns out that one important conclusion is that efforts to commemorate this pivotal moment are driven as much by the need to bolster one of the most impoverished regions of the country as they are anything else. Dave Tell is the author of Remembering Emmett Till. He's a professor of communication studies at the University of Kansas and the principal investigator of the Emmett Till Memory Project. Dave, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Nice to be here.
You know, there's a picture that KU put up in connection with a story on this book that features you and a man named Simeon Wright. It's a picture of the two of you in front of Bryant's Grocery in Money, Mississippi, where young Emmett Till supposedly whistled at an older white woman. And again, an event that triggered this entire story. Simeon Wright has passed away since the photo was taken in 2014. But I'm wondering, what did he say about that history-altering moment? Did Emmett Till actually whistle at Carolyn Bryant? What did he say about the whole thing?
That's a great question. I don't remember what Simeon said on that August day in 2014, but I can tell you that all of the eyewitnesses to the events at Bryant's Grocery, including Simeon Wright, including the still-living Wheeler Parker, including Emmett Till's mother, although she was not an eyewitness. But if you look at what those people said closest to the events in 1955, there's a unanimous agreement that he whistled. Now, as time goes on, some people change their minds. There was a theory that maybe this was an effect of his polio as a child, that he was trying to speak and it came out as a whistle. And I guess at the end of the day, we can never be too sure whether or not he whistled. But for most of the people who were there, and in most of their earliest recollections, they all remember him whistling at Carolyn Bryant.
Remind our listeners about this case. You know, who was Emmett Till? What was he accused of doing exactly?
So Emmett Till was a 14-year-old African-American boy from Chicago. In the summer of 1955, he finished up summer school in Chicago and went to visit his cousins in the town of Money, a little town of 350 people in 1955. And it was to be a vacation with his cousins. Halfway through the vacation, he and his cousins go to Bryant's Grocery and Meat Market. The main attraction was a checkers game on the front porch. And for a couple minutes, Emmett Till was alone inside the building with the 21-year-old shopkeeper, Carolyn Bryant. We don't know exactly what happened in there, but we do know that when he came out and when she came out, he whistled. She started walking to her car, which the cousins interpreted as she was going for a gun. Emmett Till may not have known that his whistle sort of upset the social norms of the Jim Crow South, but his cousins definitely knew. They pushed him into the car, and they took off across the dirt roads for a 2.8-mile trek back to the house where they lived. And you know they were scared. And the reason we know they're scared is because on that 2.8 miles, a pickup truck pulls up behind them, and they thought this truck was coming after them. So they pull over, and they run straight out into the cotton fields. And if you've been to Mississippi, you know that cotton only grows, what, like 3 feet tall? It's a horrible place to hide. So they're on their bellies, crawling through the cotton, and that's a measure of just how scared they were. It turns out that truck was not after them. They slowly recomposed themselves, made their way to the house, and they thought they had gotten away with it.
So 3 days after he supposedly whistled at Carolyn Bryant, what happened to him?
Carolyn's husband, Roy, and his half-brother, J.W. Milam, alongside of some other accomplices, showed up at the house of Till's cousins at 2 a.m. They kidnap him. They drive him out to Sunflower County, which is about a 30-mile drive west. They torture him so badly that a chunk of his skull falls free. They shoot him, and eventually they tie his or affix his body to a 75-pound cotton gin fan with a length of barbed wire, and they sink him in a Mississippi river. They were obviously hoping the river would hide the body. It didn't. 3 days later, the body was found by a 17-year-old fisherman named Hodges, who incidentally just passed in this month. Then the two white men were actually brought to trial a month later. They were acquitted by an all-white jury. I think the story gets interesting. After the trial, an activist named T.R.M. Howard travels from Mississippi over to Alabama, and he tells Till's story from the pulpit of Dexter Avenue Baptist Church. In the audience that night is a young woman named Rosa Parks, who 3 days later refuses to give up her seat on a Montgomery bus, and the civil rights movement as we know it is off and running.
You know, your book, Remembering Emmett Till, deals mainly with how this event is being commemorated today. You know, this really struck me, Dave, that Bryant's Grocery, where this incident supposedly occurred, has fallen into ruin. But the adjacent Ben Roy's service station was renovated with state taxpayer dollars. I should point out, in an attempt to talk about Delta history. Explain that to me. Why would the grocery store, which is central to this story, be in ruins while a nearby gas station was renovated at great expense to the state?
Wow. I think this is one of the saddest stories I tell in the whole
book.
And it's really, this is the story that when I started to put this puzzle together in 2014, this is when I knew I needed to write the book. So the grocery store, if you can picture it in 1955, it's just a little sort of roadside rural country store. After the trial, within weeks of the trial, because it was kept up financially by patronage from the local black population, clearly they were not too interested in giving their money to that store after the trial. So within 3 weeks, the store was up for sale. The Bryants took off for Texas. But it sort of, the building stayed a country store for about 30 years until the early 1980s. It was bought by the Tribble family. Now, the critical piece here is Ray Tribble, who in 1955 was a juror on the Emmett Till trial. And by the time they bought the property in the 1980s, and by the time he passed in the early 2000s, he was an unrepentant juror. Till the day he died, Ray Tribble believed that the body was planted by the NAACP and the men were innocent. But in the wake of the trial, Tribble becomes a massively successful farmer, and he buys up all the surrounding, all the land around Money. I think he was just trying to patch together the various fields he owned, and Money was like a spot he needed. So he ended up buying the entire town with the exception of the Baptist Church. Now, if you fast forward into the 21st century, Tribble's kin, both one generation beneath him and then ultimately two generations beneath him, now own Bryant's Grocery. And in 2011, the state of Mississippi had this program where they set aside some money.
Like $5 million, right?
No, it wasn't that much. That was like the $5 million number is the total amount spent in the Delta.
All right.
Here in money, we're talking like $250,000. But they set aside that money to do civil rights work, and the Tribble family submitted an application to the Department of Archives and History to do civil rights work, except not on the grocery store. They wanted to repair Ben Roy's service station, which is like an old sort of gas station, and they got the grant. Now, the sad part of the story is this. They got the grant by promising that they would use Ben Roy's to tell the Emmett Till story. And you know what? They had a decent logic. They said, you know what? The grocery store is crumbling. Hurricane Katrina had taken off the roof and a story-sized portion of the north wall. It was unsafe to even be close to the building. So they proposed, you know what? We'll use Ben Roy's grocery store and we'll turn it into, I think they called it in the application, like a cultural center or a visitor center where people can come and from the comfort of the service station, learn the history of the grocery store. With that logic, they got $250,000 state dollars set aside for civil rights, but they renovated the gas station. And the tragic part is this, the renovation makes not a single mention of Emmett Till, of the building to its north, or even the civil rights movement. They did a lot of work sort of recreating sort of a Leave It to Beaver 1950s scene with sort of recreated gas pumps, recreated cash registers, sort of a nostalgic sort of colorblind look at 1950s Mississippi, but they say nothing and invested no money in telling the civil rights story.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the 1955 murder of 14-year-old Emmett Till, an incident that triggered the civil rights movement as we know it today. Staying with the commemoration theme, you also point out that the commemoration of the cotton gin from where the fan was stolen that weighed Emmett Till's body down in the river has received way more attention than the murder site. It's because the site of the cotton gin is surrounded by poverty and the murder site is not. Explain that to us.
Yeah, I think you're right, Steve. The sort of, I mean, if you've been to the Delta, if anyone has been to the Delta, it's a place where you're going to see extreme poverty within hours of entry. And so poverty has become one of the driving factors shaping not just Till commemoration, but poverty is shaping the story that we all think we know about the night Till was killed. And a great example of that is the little town of Glendora. It's one of the poorest towns in one of the poorest regions in one of the poorest states.
Only five streets, but 18 markers related to Emmett Till's death in Glendora, Mississippi.
True. Can you see a little bit of the desperation?
Yes, here? Absolutely. Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, you'll go with that. And tell us about the fan.
Okay, so in 2010, the state of Mississippi sent a team of economic development experts to Glendora to say, how can we rescue this town from poverty? But they could not come up, I'm not making this up, they could not come up with anything other than the town of Glendora needs to double down on its sort of history of Emmett Till, maybe generate some tourism dollars. The trouble is this, that the Glendora mayor, a man named Johnny B. Thomas, had been trying to do this for some time. But there's two problems. Like, the story of Emmett Till only kind of intersects with the town of Glendora unless it's true that the fan came from the Glendora gin. So Mayor Thomas has been trying to sell that story to the Department of Archives and History. That is the same body that funded Ben Roy's service station. But if they gave lots of money to Ben Roy's, they do not believe Mayor Thomas. And so they have refused to give Glendora any money. And so Mayor Thomas has gotten creative. He's funded his own museum by sort of taking money that was set aside for internet development by the USDA, using money developed by Section 8 housing, and using that to sort of build a museum and put up 18 different signs, all of which tell a controversial story about the fan being stolen from the Glendora cotton gin.
Huh. Dave Tell is my guest. He's the author of a new book, Remembering Emmett Till. And this is one of the main points of your book, right? That the way we recall this moment has everything to do with racism and patronage and controversy. Am I seeing that right?
Absolutely. The story we think we know about the night Till was killed turns on all sorts of things in addition to, like, good history. Like, it turns on the town of Glendora needs internet and it needs money. And so there's like, okay, well, we'll shift the story so that Fan is stolen from here. Or the Tribbles want to sort of save the gas station. So then that sort of turns the Delta into this, like, Leave It to Beaver place. And all along the way, the story of Emmett Till is changing. And the changes track not with accurate history, but rather with the need for commercial development.
I'm wondering what the leaders of the civil rights movement today think about this, or are they even aware of it?
I don't know that I know the answer to that question, Steve.
Yeah, but you wonder at some point when this book gets out there, they might find out, and that wouldn't sit too well with them, you wouldn't think anyway.
No, I don't think so. But on the other hand, I mean, it's not just a negative story. One of the sort of striking things about the Emmett Till case is that if you start with the murder in August of 1955, you have to wait 49 years and 11 months before the first dollar is spent on Emmett Till commemoration in the state of Mississippi. That was a long time to wait. And starting in 2005, and then with a little more energy in 06 and 07, people started building these memorials. And sure, right, they are driven by tourism, and sure, there's some questionable history, but there's also a lot of good coming out of it. Like, people are talking about the Till murder in ways that it was never talked about for 50 years. So there's definitely a positive spin to this as well.
So if our listeners hearing this, Dave, want to take a trip to Mississippi to check out the Freedom Trail, this effort to commemorate the civil rights movement down there and these different sites connected to Emmett Till, what would they gain from the experience? Would it be worth the trip?
Absolutely. I can tell you firsthand that learning Emmett Till by reading my book is a different experience from learning Emmett Till because you're in the spaces where history happened, or you're in the spaces where people are trying to make you believe history happened, whatever the case may be. But certainly there's an experiential part of being in the Delta, of seeing the cotton, of experiencing the oppressive heat, of being in a place that's still more segregated than most of the spaces in which at least I move on a daily basis. There's a sort of power to learning that story on site that can't be replaced.
You know, you are the principal investigator of the Emmett Till Memory Project. I can't help but wonder how a Kansas professor gained a position like that that seems to have Mississippi as its base.
I'm amazed by that, too, truth be told. But here's the backstory. It was in 2006, this local group of Mississippi citizens got together and said, we are tired of this 49 years of silence. We're going to take matters into our own hands. And we're going to commemorate the murder. That group of citizens became known as the Emmett Till Memorial Commission. And in 2008, they started putting up signs. And you may have seen what happened to these signs. They were shot. They were stolen. They were thrown in the river. They were defaced with acid. They were spray painted with the letters KKK. The vandalism became so persistent that in 2014, the nonprofit, the ETMC, called a meeting to sort of address the question of how do we commemorate the murder in a context of vandalism. They invited Simeon Wright, who we started the show talking about, Till's cousin. They invited FBI agent Dale Killinger. They invited historian Devery Anderson and some other historians and local activists. And they invited me. And I never quite I didn't understand initially why I was invited, because they did not need help figuring out what happened in 1955. They had an eyewitness. They had the FBI agent. They had historians. But I was invited because at that time, I had written an essay about how Look magazine's pursuit of profit was shifting the story of Emmett Till. That essay was circulating in the Delta, and they realized that they knew what happened in 1955, but they didn't know what had happened to Till's story since 1955. And that's really what my book is about, and that's why I got invited. And it was at that conference in 2014 that the idea of the Emmett Till Memory Project was born. The basic idea is that's a smartphone app that will take tourists and students and visitors to the sites of Till's murder, give them pictures, narratives, archival documents, everything they need. The basic idea is that it's harder to vandalize a smartphone app than it is to vandalize a sign
That's
in a world.
Interesting. Hey, how did you get started on this premise of your book of how the region is commemorating this murder today?
Honestly, it started out in places like Glendora and like Money when I learned that Glendora was funding the only museum in the world dedicated to Till's story, was funded by Section 8 housing and a USDA grant that was supposed to build internet. I'm like, that is crazy. And then I went to Money and I learned that $250,000 that was supposed to support civil rights had gone to this gas station. I just kept on finding these stories that kind of boggled my mind. And the more I dug into these stories, the more I realized their far-reaching consequences, that these sort of small-town stories were changing the national story of Till's murder. And once I realized that, it was kind of like, okay, I got to write this book.
So as we leave this conversation, then, what are the prospects that the grocery store, which is so central to this story, will one day be resurrected and rebuilt?
I have hope. I'm a consultant to a committee called the Committee to Save Bryant's Grocery. It has family members, it has lawyers, it has activists. And this past fall, we offered a lot of money for a building that cost the Tribble family, I think, $32 a year in taxes or something like that. They countered with an even more extravagant offer.
Wow.
We put that offer, and it was $4 million is what they wanted.
$4 million?
I know. That offer in the local newspaper, and things have broken down. But we are still hopeful. There are still ideas we're shooting around. We still, at least the committee does, not me personally, but the committee still has contact with the Tribble family. The
right.
Tribble family, I mean, depending on what generation you're talking to, has a strong desire to do things
right.
So who knows what will happen, but I'm hopeful.
Dave Tells, the author of Remembering Emmett Till. He's a professor of communication studies over at KU. Dave, thanks so much for taking some time. I appreciate it.
You're so welcome.
Tomorrow, the decades-old practice of busing to desegregate schools is back in the news. We'll recall Kansas City's use of busing in the past and discuss modern efforts to make public schools in America more diverse. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Emily Aiken. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.